thing that I have found to be helpful is to just really take the time to get in touch with your own sensory issues. Mm-hmm. And you can just fill out the sensory checklist on yourself.
Welcome to the Sensory Project Show with Rachel and Jessica. We're here to share all things sensory, occupational therapy, parenting, self-care, and overall health and wellness from a therapist's perspective, providing raw, honest, fun ideas and strategies for parents and families to implement into daily life. Thank you so much for joining us. We recently launched our very first online course, the Sensory Diet Crash Course. We walk you through how to identify sensory preferences, how to identify when a sensory diet will be beneficial, and we provide you with all the activity ideas to include. We also teach you how to sequence the sensory diet and give you strategies for success. You can find the link for the Sensory Diet Crash Course in the show notes of this episode. This episode is brought to you by the Sensory Project Club, our membership website. We like to call it the podcast on steroids.
This is where we provide specific sensory strategies, activities, and exercises to promote sensory integration, primitive reflex integration, and overall success with daily life tasks.
Members also have access to exclusive live trainings, mini activity courses, and discounts on products, as well as our online courses.
The club is only open for registration the first 4 days of the month, so you don't want to miss out.
Go to thesensoryprojectclub.com for more information, or just click the link in our show notes.
See you there.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Sensory Project Show with Rachel and Jessica. Today we are talking with our sensory inspiration, Gwen from Sensational Brain.
We connected with her because she created these amazing products called the Brain Work Sensory Diet Tool. Mm-hmm. And something that we use every day in our treatment. We promote it to our clients. We promote it on our website. We've collaborated with Gwen and Sensational Brain. It's just, there is so many amazing things on her website. Mm-hmm. And we just couldn't wait to talk to her.
Yes. So we hope you guys enjoy this conversation. We asked her a lot of great questions, and she just has, she's got a great way of putting her sensory goggles on and helping her clients.
She really does. Mm-hmm. Okay. Enjoy. So we start our interviews with five secret questions that you know nothing about.
Oh boy. Okay.
All right. The first one is, what does your evening routine look like?
You know, it depends on the evening, but I guess I would say a normal evening starts with dinner, and I'm not a big cook. So we've tried all the different food service things like Blue Apron, and this week we're trying Hungry Root, and my 17-year-old daughter is a health nut.
Oh.
So she likes to eat super clean. She is vegan. I'm kind of mostly vegetarian, so we do a lot of that kind of food, and my husband. So between the three of us, hardly ever are we all three here, but if we are, whoever's here sits down together, and then I walk the dogs. And then I usually work another hour or so.
Okay.
In the evening, just to get a few more things crossed off my plate. And then we always sit down and chill a little bit. And we watch, my husband and I, let's see, what are we watching right now? We just started a new Netflix series called Dark. I think it's from somewhere else, Germany maybe, like you have to watch subtitles.
Oh, so, I wouldn't like that.
You have to really concentrate. You know, you can't be checking your phone because you'll miss the whole plot point.
Yeah.
But that's kind of a typical routine. And then we're early to bed, early to rise people. Mm-hmm. So usually head into bed at 9:30 or 10.
Nice.
And I'm a big reader. So get in bed and read a while and start again early.
There awesome. You go. I like it.
Okay. Yeah. So do you prefer summer or winter?
Summer, for sure. I especially love our Michigan summers. It's green and beautiful and like 80 degrees typically. Mm. And, when we used to live in the South, like Texas and Mississippi, I was far less of a summer fan then. And before we moved here, I was all kinds of excited about getting winters with lots of snow, but I've been progressively less excited each year since then.
I don't blame you.
Yeah.
It's a little long.
Yeah. No kidding.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What is your dessert of choice?
Chocolate. Any form of chocolate.
Any.
I typically just keep a bag of dark chocolate chips in the cabinet, and I have some. Oh, I love it. Brooke's the greatest. Love it. Yes. So I'll often have just like a handful of chocolate chips and marshmallows on a regular basis. But, yum. You know, if we were to get fancy, then I love creme brulee and those dark chocolate mud cakes, those kind of things.
Oh, so good.
I do love the creme brulee. That is, that's a delicacy.
It is. It's not chocolate, but it's really, really good.
Yes. All right. Next question. What is one word that others use to describe you?
Let me think. What do they describe me?
Ask the girl who only knows you for one day.
She told me this morning. I get a lot of comments about how much I smile. Smiley, would that be an adjective?
Yes.
It is hard for me to not smile. Yeah. So I get a lot of comments about that. I don't know if they really call me smiley, but it's probably the comments that I get the most.
Right.
Yes.
Great.
Love that one.
Okay, last one. It's our favorite one. What is your sensory quirk?
I have a lot.
Okay.
I think that's probably why I've specialized in sensory
things. Us too.
Yes, yes.
I think most of us probably do, to be able to get it.
Yeah.
I am very picky about my clothing, and I do like to look cute, especially like when I'm doing seminars for a crowd of people. You know, it is important to me that I look somewhat stylish. But if I have to choose one or the other, I will choose comfort. And that's what's lovely about the days I get to work from my home office, because I do wear yoga pants and sweatshirts, just like you guys.
That's what I'm wearing.
That's a huge perk.
Yes.
So I would probably say clothing is my biggest thing. I am very picky about how my clothing. I'm even really struggling today. Like, this is super soft.
Yeah.
But it's kind of this turtleneck sweater. Sort of bothers me, but I haven't changed yet, so I'm coping, but
good,
it's not
you.
My favorite, I decided.
That's the beauty of it, is you're able to cope for the most part and be able to modulate that.
Usually I am. Now, I did wear, last week to one of the conferences, I wore these shoes that were super cute. And I thought, oh, they're pretty comfortable. You know how you try them on in the shoe store and you think, I think I can handle this. And about 3 hours in, I could not handle it. So I was barefoot the rest of the day. But, you know, the vast majority of the people who attend are women, and they're like, I get it. So it was okay.
It was fine. You can just explain why you had to take your shoes off.
Right. Women get it.
It's a good learning opportunity.
Yes, women
get
it. Well, let's jump into the good stuff. Tell us who you are, why you do what you do, and how you do all the things.
Okay. Well, we kind of touched on this in the 5 secret questions, but I do have a husband who I've been married to for almost 26 years. And we're opposites. He's social and outgoing, and I'm basically an introvert. He's in a band. I'm totally not musical. But we balance each other out well. He brings the fun and the laughter, and I don't know what I bring, but something apparently.
The smiles.
That's right. And we have 3 daughters who are 21, 19, and 17. So they're all, 2 of them are away at college most of the year. And then the 17-year-old still is at home. And they're all different, you know, and so that's been fun to raise them all differently. And I'd say pretty much all 5 of us have some sensory issues.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also kind of motivated me down this path. And I'm an OT, but we're going to get more into that in a little bit. For fun, I jog. We're now training for a half marathon.
Nice.
And I've done a couple of those before, and 10Ks and 5Ks. And so I'm a little bit of a runner. And let's see. Outside of work, I was just telling my student here that I'm a CASA volunteer, court-appointed special advocate, where we are matched up with kids in the foster care system.
Oh.
And I feel like it's been a really good match for me as an OT, because we kind of get the effect of trauma on the brain, and a lot of these kids were exposed to drugs in utero. Mm-hmm. And so it's a volunteer role, but I often find myself putting on my OT cap when I go see my CASA kids. And I've loved that. And we're involved at church. In fact, I just got to help set up a sensory room in our church.
That I love it. That's so good.
It was so cool. It was very fun because we were mainly setting it up to just be a calming space for some kids that are just struggling, you know. It's overstimulating in that children's wing a lot of the time. And so we have two little boys in particular who were really having a hard time, and I work in there on Sundays. And then I guess my little secret vices are I love medical dramas. I finished Grey's Anatomy, and now I'm well into Chicago Med.
You have to watch Private Practice.
I've already been.
Oh, you have? Good.
Yes, love that. And I watched, what's the one from Australia? Offspring. That's a great one. About a female OBGYN and her life drama. That was really fun.
Need to write that one down.
Night Shift. Have you watched Night Shift yet?
No.
That's good, too. That's good. I watch. See, in Michigan, we have to exercise indoors a lot of the months. You know, you probably get that. Mm-hmm. And so I've made it through a lot of those running on the treadmill.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, that's what makes treadmill bearable.
Yeah. And
I read a lot of, for reading, I just, you know, because I tend to be serious and in my head too much. So when I read, I just like reading fluffy little stuff. So I've been reading what this whole genre of books called romantic comedy books that are very much like romantic comedy movies, but so they're just fun and light. So that's me.
Yeah.
And dogs. We have lots of animals around here. We have dogs, cats. We had rabbits until recently, but they finally all died off.
Finally?
they were around a while, and we had a tortoise, but my daughter just gave her to a friend this week because tortoises live like 75 years.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Not feeling it anymore.
No, that's a long time.
I do have to ask, what kind of dogs do you have?
We have an older dog who's half corgi and half border collie. Okay. She was a rescue dog. And then we have a little Yorkie who is the true baby of the household and spoiled rotten little thing. She usually sits right behind my behind.
Oh.
All day.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Okay. So now talk about what you do for work, because that's the really good stuff. I mean, I like your personal life stuff too, but
primarily right now I run my business, Sensational Brain. And with Sensational Brain, we primarily do continuing education. I do live seminars, some of those on my own, some of those I contract for companies like PESI. And then I do webinars through my website. And I have multiple other presenters who also do webinars for our site. And most of those are 1 to 3 hours in length for the most part. We are AOTA approved and then more recently ASHA approved. So most of our attendees are OTs and SLPs. Mm-hmm. And then we also have our product line called BrainWorks that's available through the website too. So that's primarily what I do. I travel a lot, especially this spring, almost too much, doing a lot of live seminars, which I love. That's probably my favorite thing, but the travel gets a little bit tiring once in a while. And then I do keep my hand in treatment by seeing a few kids. I do a little bit of contract work for a couple of schools near-ish me, self-contained schools for kids from counties. And then I see a few private clients too, just to kind of keep my hand in treatment. Yeah. Have new stories to tell in my courses. And
absolutely.
So, those are helpful.
Yeah.
I think they're necessary when we're creating in the online space or speaking. It kind of keeps you up to date.
It does. It keeps me current on what the trends are in school-based practice. And I have worked part-time in a clinic here in Kalamazoo, and I still keep in touch with a few friends from there. So I kind of am in the know with what's changing from a billable standpoint and all that helps with my continuing ed courses.
Definitely.
And I just enjoy it. I sometimes miss seeing kids more, and so that kind of gives me a chance to download new things from Teachers Pay Teachers and
your
resource and all those fun things to see what else is out there and what's changing.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, tell us a little bit about BrainWorks and why you created it.
Okay. BrainWorks is, we call it a sensory diet creator tool. And I started doing seminars for Summit Professional Education about 10 years ago. And my topic was creating, it was like developing an effective sensory diets for children and teens, something to that extent. And so it was all about sensory diets. And I started seeing that there was just this deficit where we could give the information to therapists and teachers, but it was still hard for them to carry it through. And to understand the difference between calming strategies and alerting strategies. And I kept thinking we need to make it visual. And I was making it visual through using pictures for pecs and photos. And I started using a different program called Stick Kids for a few years. Mm-hmm. And there were things that I liked about all of those options and things that I kept thinking, this makes more sense to my brain. And so I started kind of creating a version of BrainWorks using pictures for pecs that then I would color code with what has become BrainWorks. And I have a friend who's a graphic artist. And so I started talking to her about what would it be like to make some actual visuals for the system that I've created. And we just did a lot of research into how we should create those visuals. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure that it would make sense to kids, mm-hmm. that it would attract their eyes. And we came up with our little blue guy. We call him the blue guy. And kids are drawn to our blue guy. But we even took it a step farther into looking at what makes sense for the brains of kids on the spectrum. And a lot of the research shows that they get hung up on facial expression. And we don't want them to get hung up on the facial expression. You know, we want them to focus on the activity. Mm-hmm. So we have left facial expression off of our blue guy for the most part. Mm-hmm. You will see facial expression if you use our BrainWorks app, because we have a simpler version there that allows kids to identify their current emotion. And then we also have some blue guy emotion picks that are available within BrainWorks online for people who choose not to use the tachometer analogy. And it's just kind of a simpler way to explain it to teachers and parents and kids. But on the activity cards, there isn't a facial expression. Yeah, just that, looking at what will draw their eye and what attracts them. And so our graphic artist has done a great job of using colors that attract mm-hmm. the kids, and the kids become familiar with blue guy. And we have one social story written about blue guy, and I kind of intend to make more in the future. The one we have so far is about sensory craving, and stars our little blue guy. So through this system, we just tried to take the guesswork out of deciding what has a calming effect on the nervous system and what has an alerting effect. And we use the colored arrows to designate that along with the borders. And so that then became BrainWorks. And initially, it was a set of these cards with color coding on them, sensory activity cards. And then a couple years later, we developed BrainWorks Online, which is web-based software that allows therapists to kind of click and drag mm-hmm. the picture cards that they want to print out. So you don't have to print all 300 pictures. You can just print the pictures that apply to the kids that you're working with. Yes. And that's the goal. It's just to make it easy for teachers, it's usually the OTs, putting together the sensory program for the kids and then making it easily accessible by the kids and the teachers and the parents.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, we love them.
Yeah.
You know, we use them in our treatment every single day.
Thank you. And you guys have such unique ways of using it. I just saw your visual that you posted with the car.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I love it. That's awesome.
Yeah. So, and you know, every single kid that we've used the BrainWorks cards with enjoys using them. And, mm-hmm. you know, we have kind of organized them in a binder. And so our kids can kind of look through the binder for calming activities or alerting activities or the just right activities, and they can choose what they need.
That's awesome. I do something similar too when I'm working with kids. I have a binder with mm-hmm. a red page, a yellow page, yep. a green page, and then a blue page that's mostly task related or goal directed activities. And I'll often, and then I have on the outside of the binder, I have Velcro to become a visual schedule for our mm-hmm. therapy session. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'll often say, you know, we decide what they need. And if they need calming strategies, choose two calming strategies first. And then I get to choose something and mm-hmm. then they choose a couple. Mm-hmm. And it's a good way to give them some control over what happens in therapy to be able to organize their brains.
Yes. Well, I have a question for you. We get a lot of people reaching out, asking us what to do when the calming strategies rev up their children. And it seems to be, you know, a lot of these sensory cravers, the families want to do these calming activities, hoping to have a nice, green, calm child, yet those deep pressure, those heavy work activities are increasing their arousal level. Mm-hmm. So curious what you would share with a parent who is struggling with that.
That is challenging. And there's, I think it goes back to, we just need to figure out more. Mm-hmm. And until then, sometimes it's just trial and error. But mm-hmm. there's a couple of different theories about sensory cravers. And one theory that, that Dr. Lucy Jane Miller speaks about a lot is that the more sensory input the cravers get, the more dysregulated they get. Mm-hmm. And so to that end, proprioceptive input is primarily what's recommended. Mm-hmm. And even along with their input being mostly proprioceptive, there are some guidelines that seem to work better for the sensory cravers. And that includes adding a goal-directed component to the activity. A lot of times if the sensory cravers choose like a crawling activity, that's great because the crawling activity gives them a lot of proprioceptive input. But to make it goal-directed, we might combine that with a puzzle. So they mm-hmm. crawl through the tunnel and get a puzzle piece, crawl back to the other side and put it in the frame, go back for more. So it's goal-directed that way. And then also implementing frequent stops and starts to the activity. So we want to think about if they're engaging in an activity like the trampoline, 20 minutes of uninterrupted jumping is hardly ever helpful. Right. So we want to give it a definite stop and a definite start. And going back to goal-directed, we may say something like, jump on the trampoline while you sing the alphabet song. Nice. And that way there's a definite stop to that activity. So goal-directed, frequent stops and starts, frequent head position changes seem to be somewhat magical also. Mm-hmm. Going back to like the binder of activities, when I have kids choose strategies that we're going to engage in, and then I set up the order on the binder, or if the parent's using the file folder, let the child choose the activities and then they can control the folder. The schedule, mm-hmm. So that it would be first an activity where they're upright and then an activity where they're horizontal and then maybe an activity where they're inverted. So building in those head position changes seems to help. So far we have goal-directed, frequent stops and starts, head position changes. We already talked about making it mostly proprioceptive in mm-hmm. nature. And then sometimes it just helps to contain these kids in small spaces, mm-hmm. That can even just be providing some visual boundaries to kids. Like if we're going to meet your sensory needs in our living room, let's do it between the couch and the chair mm-hmm. and don't go outside this little space. Mm-hmm. And just to even provide that visual boundary seems to help kids, because what we do see is these little sensory cravers start getting a little bit of input and they get a little bit amped up and then they start running circles around the house rather yes. than continuing to engage in these activities that will actually mm-hmm. keep them helpful. So it's a combination of recognizing that potential for them to get more and more escalated, and that's where the boundaries come in place. But here's also my statement about sensory cravers. I do see that point that sometimes they can become more dysregulated, but I think we also have to think about it from a threshold standpoint, where it can be our natural tendency to want to use calming strategies for sensory cravers. But I still feel like, in general, we need to think about reaching their really high yes. threshold. And to get to that threshold, I often feel like it's the alerting, stimulating activities that are going to help us get there and get the child where we want them to be, rather than mm-hmm. traditional calming strategies. Right. Even though that seems to make sense, yeah. is to use calming, I think we need to use alerting within the confines of those boundaries.
Yes.
To really help them reach that threshold where neurochemical change takes place.
Yes.
But the downside to that is it can take a long time yeah. to effectively reach that threshold.
Yeah.
So I think where parents and teachers get frustrated is they think, okay, I get it that we want to use stimulating activities within these boundaries, but they feel like after 10 or 15 minutes, we should be seeing change. And 10 or 15 minutes later, the kids are often more wound up than mm-hmm. before they began. So we just have to keep going till we can either reach that threshold. Ideally, that's what we do. Keep going till we reach the threshold. But if we decide it takes so long to reach that threshold that it's not feasible, that's when we might need to consider traditional calming strategies instead.
Yeah.
I like to call it plan A and plan B. Plan A for a sensory craver is to reach that threshold with those guidelines in place. Mm-hmm. Plan B, if we decide it takes 60 minutes to reach that threshold and you know you don't have 60 minutes, you only have 10 minutes before you have to head out the door, then go with calming strategies instead. And that's a time where we really want to pull out all the stops from a calming standpoint. Mm-hmm. Weighted blankets, getting them into flexion, maybe putting some special music on to try to bombard them with a large amount of more traditional calming input to try to get them closer to where do we want them to be within 10 minutes.
Yes. And then ideally they learn that and they're able to implement that on their own. I mean, I had a kiddo tell me we were doing the peanut rocking activity every day for a month. That was their home exercise program. And once the month was up, we moved on to our next exercise. And the client's mom told me, you know, the kiddo needed a brain break and he independently chose to do the peanut rocking to self-regulate. And I'm like, gosh, I'm going to cry. That's amazing. But it really, it takes that consistency to figure it out and to find it, and for parents and the kiddos.
Mm-hmm. It does. And it's the hardest for those sensory cravers. It's far easier for us to figure out what the over-responders need or the little passive bump on the log types need. Yep. Much harder to figure out what the sensory cravers need and what's going to get them there in the shortest amount of time. Yes. It's a lot of trial and error.
I feel like sometimes that can make families
discouraged.
Discouraged, yes. Yes. They're like, oh, I have to try this and this and it's not working, so I'm just not going to try anything at all. Instead of trying something consistently for a week, seeing if it works, if it's not, modifying it and trying something different the next week.
Right. And that's where outpatient OT can be helpful, because ideally in OT we can figure out what it takes and then send them home with options to get there in a reasonable amount of time at home.
Yes.
And then also, just like you've said, where you just really look at where the child is going, you know, what have they already figured out? Mm-hmm. Usually they're telling us what they need and we just have to be observant enough to figure out what that is.
Yeah,
totally.
So that wasn't a very succinct answer, but
no, that's okay.
It's just not always too cut and dried with those kids.
It's not.
It's never.
Well, because all the kids are different and all of the kids are going to react differently to the same activity.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you know, once in a while, I just always also point out that sometimes what seems to be a really high sensory threshold isn't sensory. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm working with one little guy now and he was exposed in utero to stimulants. And I just have really come to the conclusion there isn't a threshold to be reached for him, you know? So once we figure that out, I think it's just due to brain changes, probably too many dopamine receptors from in utero exposure. Mm-hmm. And so we probably aren't going to get there through sensory strategies alone. We're going to use sensory strategies, but we also need to use cognitive behavioral therapy interventions. We also need to use rewards and consequences. Just really treat that kind of an issue holistically.
Yeah.
Every kid's so unique, so different.
So unique. And we can't see into the brain, so we don't always know for sure what that underlying issue is.
Yes. True. I know. I did take your course on the neurotransmitters, and that was just so eye-opening. And, oh, I love learning about that stuff. And it was so overwhelming. I failed the test the first time, because I'm like, I don't know.
Lots of people fail that test. It's a hard test because it's a hard course.
It really is.
How many times people have to take a test, and it's a high.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm not the only one. Thank you. That makes me feel better.
I recently remade that test because I think it was a little too hard.
Oh well, thanks. Like,
why is everyone failing?
I know.
It's hard. It is hard. I think I made the test a little too hard, but the material's hard. And it's a lot to wrap your head around. And but I love it too. And I feel like it's been so refreshing for me. I was just telling my student this morning too that, you know, it can be really discouraging when we just constantly hear there's not enough evidence to support a sensory-based form of intervention. And within our field, we are getting more research. But once I started figuring out about the neurochemicals, I kept thinking, this is where our research is, you know, when we see what it takes to change dopamine levels and we find out most of those things that change dopamine levels are what we've been calling proprioceptive input for years.
Weird.
Yes. You think this is where our research needs to be focused on. Totally. And I'm really fascinated by that too. I'm now taking Dr. Daniel Amen has a 50-hour course to become a certified brain health coach. It's super interesting because he shows you SPECT imaging, which is functional brain imaging, where you can see what's going on in different parts of the brain and how different parts of the brain respond to different forms of input. And so I just think that is where we need to be focusing our research efforts on, to be able to show that we are making changes.
Yeah.
Just the rest of your strategy. So it is super interesting stuff. Glad you enjoyed it, even though you failed the test. Did you
pass? What's that?
Did you eventually pass?
Yeah, it only took me 2 tries.
Oh, good for you, then. You're a pro.
I could just ask you so many questions. You're like the sensory goddess.
Yeah, no kidding.
Right.
Well, and we're obsessed with sensory diets, you know? Yes. So.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, I'll ask you another one. I've got another one. Only because people keep asking me these questions, and then it inspires my own research, and I'm struggling to find research, but the connection between sensory processing disorder and cerebral palsy. It's there. I know the connection is there.
Totally there.
But in my preliminary research, I'm not finding the connection. And the only connection that I can find is prematurity and the white matter in the brain. But there's no distinct articles that I've been able to find so far that say, yeah, there's a connection. Let's try this and let's implement this approach.
Right. You know, I have some big opinions on that. And first of all, you know, it depends on where, like, cerebral palsy is usually due to brain bleeds in utero or oxygen deprivation. So it makes sense that if the sensory cortex or the thalamus are affected, then definitely we're going to not be surprised to see sensory processing disorder too. But I also think it's secondary. I think, you know, here's a perfect example. Back when our own girls were little, we became foster parents to one of my patients.
Oh, wow.
And we became foster parents to get him. And so he was born with cerebral palsy, and then he was shaken at 11 months of age. So he had shaken baby syndrome to compound his issues, okay? So this was just an interesting case study that unfolded right in front of my eyes. He's literally within a few months of being the same age as my middle daughter. So he moved in with us when he was about 15 months of age. And then he went back home soon after he turned 2. So we had him about a year. So during that time, they both went, you know, early on, they were fairly similar where they were both, my daughter was late to walk. So they were both, you know, basically floor bound. My daughter was crawling when he came to live with us. He wasn't crawling. He has spastic diplegic cerebral palsy. So he always had better use of his arms than of his legs. And so he became an army crawler, but early on he was very immobile. And then, so Eden, my daughter, starts to walk and she starts to talk and, you know, just here's a perfect example, you know, where one day I remember thinking, this is when this little light went off in my head. That same day, she's, you know, they're like 18 months of age and she had been all over the place, spilled the toys, picked up the toys, had numerous pseudo conversations with me and her sister and had sampled the cat food and, you know, licked the toy, the scrub brush, things like that typical 18 months olds do that just flood their little brains with so much sensory input. And I remember thinking that day, she has worn me out and Billy has barely moved, you know? And I tried to be stimulating for him. I was a stay-at-home mom that year, but I had a 3-year-old and two 1-year-olds. And two of them had fairly significant needs. And so I couldn't always be right there for him. So during that same time that she's been all over the house, he has been within this 2-foot little radius. And so, you know, over those months that she's developing and exploring their environment, he started to engage in repetitive activities because that's what he could do. It's all he could do.
Yeah.
So he'd bang things, or one of the things that he loved to do, it was just funny. he loved it when we would, he would just end up by, or we would start putting him by when we realized how much he loved it for short periods of time. He loved being in front of a door, and he would like fling the door shut, and he didn't have enough strength to make it latch. So it would swing back open, and he liked like the wind in his face and the sound and the visual input. And usually I would let him do that for a couple minutes because he loved it. But then I would get him involved in something more stimulating. But just the OT and me one day, I was like, how long would he be happy doing that? Mm-hmm. And so I, just to do my own little research experiment, I set him up in front of his bedroom door and I just timed him. And he was perfectly happy for 1 hour and 45 minutes.
Wow.
What?
Right? And so, you know, clearly, you know, I'm an OT and I knew that wasn't awesome for him to be doing the same activity for an hour and 45 minutes. But if you think about parents who don't know, or parents who are busy, and in their mind, they're thinking, well, he's happy, so what's wrong with it? But what's wrong with it is what he's missing out on during that time. He's missing out on all multisensory stimulation. Mm-hmm. And so he became an over-responder to sensory input.
Yes.
In some regards. In other regards, he's a big-time sensory craver.
Right.
You know? So that's not really surprising considering what they're able to access. Mm-hmm. He craves proprioceptive and vestibular input. And he is from Kansas, where my parents live. So when we would go back there, we would pick him up for the day. And, you know, our friends had this big backyard trampoline. This is when he was older and we were just visiting. And he loved, he's still non-mobile, but or non-ambulatory. So we put him on the backyard trampoline and the girls would all jump around him. And he would like laugh so hard he turned blue. Craves that input, you know? And so these kids usually do become cravers for proprioceptive and vestibular input because they can't get it on their own. Meanwhile, they often become over responsive to multisensory input because they don't have, they never learn to assimilate that unless they get really good intervention. So I think sometimes the sensory processing piece goes along with whatever brain damage caused the damage to the motor cortex. And then I think other times it's secondary, you know, because they're just not experiencing the degree of sensory processing that their typically developing peers are experiencing.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. They're not getting the input.
Yeah.
How cool.
It's kind of like sensory deprivation.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a way.
How cool that you have that example, though. I mean, you had that situation, and you were able to kind of do your own research on it.
Right. That's really interesting. And it just triggered a lot of big thoughts to me that year that we had him, of what we need. You know, we need to just be making sure that we're always looking at their age-appropriate peers and thinking, what type of input are they getting? And then do whatever we can to make sure the kids with CP get that same input. Like when their peers are experiencing the world upright, we need to get them upright, you know? Because our brain does have pretty small windows for development. And we want to make sure that we are mirroring that as closely as we can.
Yeah, absolutely. That's such a great, great tip
to
think about for our kids.
Yeah, yeah. Always want to be thinking about what they should be getting and try to give them that.
Yeah.
Not even necessarily what skills should they be able to do, but just what input should they be getting for their age.
Yeah. Absolutely. How do we want them to experience the world?
Yes.
I think about this in the NICU often. I've never worked in a NICU. I've never had any experience in the NICU, but I just feel like with those babies who are premature, they're missing out on movement from within the womb. I mean, you think about while they're in the womb, they're moving, they're bouncing, they're upside down, they're spinning, they're getting all of this input.
And auditory input.
Everything. And then primitive reflex stimulation, and they're out and they're laying on their back for however long they need to lay on their back. And I'm like, what could we do to change how the NICU is? I don't know the answer. I wish I did.
Yeah.
But I just think that's
missing. I know they're becoming more aware of that. They're doing more skin-to-skin time with parents and trying to get the babies in prone skin-to-skin with parents. But it's still, you know, it's limited based on everybody's schedule, based on how well they're breathing. There's still a lot of limiting factors there. But I think at a minimum, if we could create some type of a little device to keep them in flexion, you know, that would be a good start. But, you know, I hadn't thought about the movement in utero. That's true.
Yeah.
I know I just toured our hospital. They have a, in their NICU, they have, I think it's called the kangaroo pod or something like that. And it's like this little pod they put the babies in, and it swings them all over in multiple directions.
What?
And they're finding, they're not using it on preemies to my knowledge, but they're using it on the babies born addicted.
Okay.
And babies born addicted to coke and meth, they're just miserable little babies.
Yeah.
And they said the only time they stop crying is when they're in this thing.
Wow.
With getting that movement.
I didn't get to see it because the baby was kicking it, and yeah, we weren't allowed in, but I wanted to look into it.
What's it called again?
The kangaroo pod.
It's some kangaroo something.
Kangaroo pod, ouch.
I'm going to have to look into it further,
yeah,
too.
I always have my theories, you know, with these kids that I work with, and I just feel like I connect the dots so much when I have multiple kiddos with these sensory challenges. They don't have any other diagnoses, and I'm a CODA, so I don't get to do the initial evaluations, and so I get to kind of draw on my own research with these families. And, you know, this mom was on bed rest with this kid, and this mom was on bed rest, and I started thinking, these moms who are on bed rest for whatever reason, these kids aren't getting that input, that movement. They're not, whatever
right,
it is,
the
they're not,
natural movement.
They're not getting that.
Yeah.
So then they come out and they're like,
right,
either I need this movement, I need more movement, or they're like, I don't know what to do when I move.
Mm-hmm.
And
right,
it develops into that sensory processing concern. And I just think that is so interesting. And
it is, and you're really onto something. I do always ask about prenatal history for
mm-hmm,
sure, and I do see some common trends. Like a lot
yeah,
of times the kids who are sensory cravers, their moms were going through a really stressful time
mm-hmm,
while they were pregnant,
yeah,
and, you know, maybe a divorce, something like that. And when I got to speak in New Zealand a couple years ago, and they do have an interesting study going on the babies who were in utero during a big earthquake that happened, now it was probably like 7 years ago in Christchurch.
Oh.
And it was huge, like hundreds of people died, everybody's, you know, lots of homes destroyed, all of that. And so they are researching the babies who were in utero at the time of the quake. And that was significant stress because there were aftershocks for weeks. And so everybody, and it's not that big of a town, so most people knew somebody who was really affected by the earthquake. So everybody was super stressed. Anyway, at the time I was there, all those kids were kindergartners, and they said they have this whole cohort of kindergartners that are big time sensory cravers.
Whoa.
But if you think neurochemically about the cortisol that was present in the mom's bloodstream while she was pregnant, and how that rewires the brain to need higher levels
yes,
of stimulation and to get used to that high level of input. It's just so interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
So ask a lot about in utero
mm-hmm,
and you'll almost always find, particularly with the sensory cravers, things
yeah,
that were going on.
Yes.
So
yeah,
interesting to me. And I feel like it gets missed so often in those
mm-hmm,
evals where moms are like,
yeah,
no, everything was fine. There were no issues, but then they don't think about, maybe there were no issues in the pregnancy, but think
right,
about what was going on in your life.
Right.
You know, and take
right,
that time and focus on
right,
what was going on.
How stressed you were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Then we're going to stress moms out about being stressed.
Oh, I know.
No, here I am stressing out and I'm like, oof.
I know.
Don't stress.
Yeah.
What's next for you professionally? You know, you're speaking at, you know, conferences and doing continuing education, but what's next? What are you doing next?
Oh, that is a big question. I've always kind of been one of those people that I'm just barely getting into something before I start thinking, what's next?
Yeah.
Maybe I have ADHD, but I have loved doing live continuing ed. I love teaching. I've loved doing the product development piece. So, you know, I've thought about different things. I've thought about teaching more. I've thought about starting a clinic. Sometimes I think about that where I would really want to focus on, I'm really loving right now this big piece where I'm looking at kids and I'm seeing it's a little bit sensory. It's a little bit cognitive behavioral. It's a little bit things that have gone on in their lives. So, and because of, you know, my work with foster kids, I think, is there a way to put all that together into a clinic where we really focus on that big picture, maybe where we have counselors and OTs working side by side,
mm-hmm,
something to that extent.
That would be cool. That would be super cool.
Yeah, it would be. So I think about things like that. I've sort of, I guess I could technically, I've started writing a book with Kim Wiggins, but have not made much progress because we're both too busy right now. And so we just were talking last night, and I think we're going to just set aside some time this summer and get together. She lives in New York and I live in Michigan, but meet somewhere kind of fun maybe and just hash it out over a period of 4 or 5 days rather than trying to drag it out over a few years and never really making progress. So
for sure. Go on a retreat together.
But that's exactly what we need, where we can get away from every distraction and focus. So maybe writing a book. I would like to do more research, but because I'm passionate that we need more research, but it's overwhelming. I led 2 research studies and largely ended up hating it by the time it was done. Yeah. I'm passionate about it, but if I found the right team, you know, or a school that would give us kind of carte blanche to be able to not have to worry about all the red tape and all that goes along with it. Mm-hmm. I like setting up the study and I like implementing the study. It's all everything that comes after that you get bogged down by. Yeah. But part of me would like that. And so I've thought about partnering with the university to do more of that. So I don't know. And then sometimes I just want to move to Cozumel and live on the beach.
So. Yep. Yep.
We'll see. Awesome.
Well, I have lots of ideas for research if you ever need some ideas that you want to carry on for me.
I was going to say, if you want to get involved in research.
Yeah.
I'll do the implementing, but none of the other stuff.
Yeah.
I know. You know, and that's where largely why we don't have enough research. It is just hard.
Yes.
You're usually, you know, it's people who are either self-funding studies, which makes it problematic, or partnering with universities takes time because of all of the protocol that you go through. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of good reasons that we don't have the amount of research that we'd like to have at this point in time.
Sure.
It's not because what we're doing doesn't work.
Right.
It's just because none of us have the time and the money to show that it works. When you think about a lot of research that's medically based, it's funded by pharmaceutical companies and people that have big pocketbooks, and we don't. None of us are getting rich. So, you know, we don't. It's hard.
It is hard
to get that
put
together.
Yes.
How can all of our listeners find you? Just soak in all of your resources. What's the easiest way for that to happen?
Well, our website is sensationalbrain.com, and that's where you can access BrainWorks as well as our continuing ed webinars and information about some live seminars that we sponsor as well. And then we are on Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, and Twitter as sensationalbrain too. Ah. So, I'm not great at social media, but I'm trying to get better. And so you can find us those places as well.
Perfect. And we'll link everything in the show notes for the episode too.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect.
I know you have a lot of...
You guys post more about BrainWorks on Instagram than I do.
It's because we love it so much.
That's awesome. I love it.
You have a lot of resources for therapists on your website, but you also have a lot of free resources for parents as well. And we've recommended your sensory processing checklist. We've recommended those to a lot of our clients as well because it's not standardized. It's easy to identify a pattern and it's free and it's easy. And it's just boom, 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 and it's done. Which I think that those types of resources need to be out there even more because parents want to figure it out. They want the tools and resources easily accessible. So I think that's important to take advantage of on your website as well for parents.
And, you know, I've learned a lot of what I know from parents, you know, parents who have happened on something that works and you can build on that.
Yeah.
Would you recommend any of your courses for parents to take?
Well, you know, parents do benefit from several of our courses. We have a free 1-hour webinar, the BrainWorks Approach to Effective Sensory Diets. And that just gives parents a good idea of how to go about starting to put together a sensory program for their child. And then we have more in-depth courses that if a parent already has a pretty good level of understanding, you know, maybe they're working with their OT and they already have a lot of good information, but just want to think about how to put it together in the home. we have a two-hour version called Effective Sensory Diets. That's a great one. And then Lori Benson Adams has a parenting series on executive functioning skills. That's a great one for parents, too, because most of our kids with sensory issues also are going to struggle with executive functioning skills.
Yeah,
and so that can kind of help connect more of the dots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And then from that point on, it just depends on how deep the parents want to dive, you know? We do have really overzealous, eager parents who want to know everything they can, and they don't seem to be overwhelmed by our content. They can participate and figure out what applies to their kids, and they kind of have the advantage of being able just to listen to the parts that really apply to them and not have to make it make sense for every kid on their caseload.
Yes.
So some parents do find those to be helpful.
Totally.
We have a Q&A blog on our website too, and a lot of parents like visiting there because I get a lot of emails from parents and I post my answers. And so we take away any identifying information before we post them, but just a good site to go to and start scrolling and realize that other people's kids have similar struggles.
Yes.
And there are some standard starting points for how we begin addressing lots of those issues that are more common than most parents think.
Yes.
Totally.
I agree.
What is one piece of advice that you can give to our listeners?
Let's see. You know, one thing that I have found to be helpful is to just really take the time to get in touch with your own sensory issues.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just fill out the sensory checklist on yourself.
Yeah.
And I usually tell people, fill it out about like your 8-year-old self, you know, or your 5-year-old self. Think back to how you were as a kid before you came up with strategies that help or that you gravitated towards certain clothing, things like that. So think back about how you were when you were a kid. And then you just start becoming aware that a lot of things that you struggle with are sensory based. Even things we don't always think about, like whether you're an introvert or an extrovert or a morning bird or a night owl, you know, a lot of those have to do with our sensory issues. And so once you start seeing that and putting it all together, then it becomes a lot easier to look at the kids, your kids, or the kids that you work with, neighbors, friends, and make sense of what their behaviors are telling you from a sensory level, because you start realizing it's not rocket science. You know, it's just, we all have little quirks about us, and we have things we prefer and things that we don't like. So just get in touch with yourself and what that means at a sensory level, and then it becomes a lot easier.
I love that.
Yeah. We always say, put your sensory goggles on.
And that's exactly what the sensory goggles are.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Recognize that it impacts every area of life.
Yes. And everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a big one.
Yeah.
Totally.
It gets largely overlooked.
Love that.
Yeah, I love it. I love your weighted vests that don't look like weighted vests.
Yeah,
I love
thank
that.
You.
Kids are often self-conscious about not wanting to wear anything that stands out. I love that. That's
yes.
so cute.
Yeah, thank you.
Did you have a particular kid that you worked with that motivated that?
Yeah, I don't remember what kid it was, but I remember we were putting on one of the Velcro fun and function jackets, you know, and the kid was like, I don't want to wear this, as I'm like trying to strap them in and the Velcro, and I don't like Velcro. That's my own sensory thing.
Yeah,
and
right.
Like, there's got to be a better way, you know?
Yeah.
So
there is.
Yeah. So we just, I called my mom and I was like, Mom, can you help me sew this? And we just kind of started from there, and it took off.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. We started a few years ago too. I was getting a lot of questions about weighted blankets. And so my mother-in-law sews, and she started making weighted blankets. They're so great, but she just doesn't have time for it anymore either, or the inclination maybe. They're time-consuming to make weighted garments.
They really are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they are. They're very soothing.
Yeah. I know. Whenever I'm feeling stressed out, I have like a sample adult weighted vest, and I'll grab it, and I'm just like, oh, I feel so much better now.
I know. It's quite startling. That's another thing, you know, where we often get kicked back about the evidence. Like, we really haven't been able to show consistently an evidence that weighted vests improve attention or anything specific like that. But I always just go back to, does it work for this child? Yeah. You know? And if it works for this child, yes. Who cares if we can see it in the bigger research?
Exactly.
And if the child is asking for it, then you know at a minimum they're more comfortable. And if Absolutely. They're more comfortable, we all do better when we're
yes.
comfortable. You know? Yeah. If we know it helps, the kids know it helps, exactly. then that's all that ultimately
that's
matters.
What matters for sure.
I know. I always, like, lend out my weighted blankets. So I have neighbors and stuff who they're like, oh, I just feel so anxious or I'm not sleeping. I'm like, well, let me give you a weighted blanket to
try. Right. Right. It's the cure-all.
I know. It's definitely rewarding to be able to have those experiences when they're like, wow, it actually worked. And
right. I know. It is. It really is.
It's fine.
Yeah, my 19-year-old sleeps under hers every single night.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't have a diagnosis, nothing. She
yeah.
just knows she feels better.
Yeah,
better.
Absolutely. Totally. Yeah. Same with me. But my husband is so different. I'll tell you this because it's kind of funny. He doesn't sleep. So he won't use a full weighted blanket. I have a 10-pound weighted blanket, and he won't use it. And so he's like, I just need something on my chest. So one night at like 10 o'clock, he's like, can you just sew me a little weighted? He calls it a chesty. And so 10 o'clock one night, I'm sewing him this 3-pound, 4-pound little weighted chesty, and he throws it on his chest and he's like, oh, okay, this is it.
That's what he needed.
Yeah. So I started sewing those for an Etsy
idea.
Shop.
A chesty.
I hate that name. I hate it, but it's so perfect.
It is.
And they're the perfect size.
That's really cute.
Yeah. So, you know, everyone's different and it's all trial and error.
Right. Yeah, I don't really like the weighted blankets either. I feel a little claustrophobic
yeah.
under them. But I like on my lap or something, I like
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah.
It is just individual preference.
It is.
And that's what makes researching hard.
Yes.
It is. That's right.
Yeah.
There's so many factors to consider.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to chat with us and
yes.
share your wisdom.
Sure thing. I enjoyed it.
Yes. Thank you. And we will chat soon.
Okay, thanks so much for having me.
Gwen is so knowledgeable, and she's so happy.
Mm-hmm. She is.
She, you know, she said her word is smiley, and it's so true, but she has really good energy.
She does, yeah.
So much good energy.
I feel like I just want to be her, you know? I really feel like she could be my mentor, you know? I've taken enough
sure.
of her courses. I'm like, I am your
she
gal
is.
Pal.
She is. She's so just. Man, she just has so much good knowledge.
Yeah.
So hopefully you guys gained some good insight into sensory diets. You know, we're passionate about sensory diets. And so this just kind of gives you a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A little bit more.
So if you guys have any questions for Gwen, if you have any questions for us, don't hesitate to reach out. We're going to post everything you need to know in the show notes and make sure to find the links to everything that we talk about, you head to the Sensory Project blog, which is linked in the show notes.
And if you go check out BrainWorks and you decide that it is right for you, we do have a discount code, so that will also be in the show notes.
Yeah. And we're going to link the app that Gwen was talking about as well.
Yes.
Because that is a resource that needs to be taken advantage of more.
Yeah, and I think, you know, especially for therapists and HIs, ABA therapists in the schools, this app is perfect to use with multiple kids.
Mm-hmm. And it's mobile. I mean,
yes.
you don't have to have the big binders that we carry around with us.
Yep.
Just whip out your phone or a tablet.
Yes, so super easy, super perfect for all of us.
And if you guys love this interview, go ahead and leave us a review on iTunes. That will help us reach more families like yours, more therapists like you, or more educators in your space.
Yep, all the things. Okay, thanks for being here.
See you guys next week.
We are so excited to work together to help create confident kids all over the world and work towards a happier, healthier life. Just a friendly reminder, this is general information related to occupational therapy, pediatrics, and sensory integration. We do not know you or your child, therefore we do not know any specific needs. Therefore, you should always refer back to your pediatrician and occupational therapist for more information.